Okay, we are on. So welcome everybody to the second installment of Lifetimes in Torah, focusing on the 17th century and specifically on the personality of Rav Shabsai HaKohen, who we may better know as the Shach, who we may better know as the Sifsei Kohen after the work that he authored. Before actually getting into it, first and foremost, a tremendous thank you to the Iluzes, to Nisanel and Panina. Thank you for opening your home so we could all come together and actually learn together. And as I said last time, you can tell a lot about a society, about a culture, from the people that that society places on a pedestal. It says a lot, unfortunately, probably, about the society in which we live presently, that celebrities become celebrities perhaps for not all the wrong reasons, but many of the wrong reasons. And the fact that we have a group that's turned out on a nasty rainy night to come and learn more about somebody who completely and exhaustively, as we'll see in the coming minutes of this year, dedicated himself to Torah, to learning Torah, to teaching Torah, et cetera, says a lot about, I think, who we are as a society and a culture. This is somebody who we place on a pedestal. This is our celebrity, Rav Shabsai HaKohen. So as you see on the front opening slide here, the years are much more limited, far more limited than the lifetime of Rav Yosef Karo, who we discussed last time. By the way, the two are somewhat connected, somewhat interrelated, as we'll see as we get into the actual authorship of Rav Shabsai HaKohen, how he's related to Rav Yosef Karo and also to the Ramah. But 1621 to 1662, lived a very, very short life. Died a very young man, even for his day.
It doesn't look very young.
That doesn't look like it's probably him, though.
So those two may go hand in hand. Yeah, this may be.
He's like Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah.
Really, Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah. The reality is that, as we'll see, the Shach had an extraordinarily difficult life, a very, very difficult life. There was a lot of running around and a lot of sort of being on the lam, much as we discussed with Rav Yosef Karo. This, unfortunately, it's the reality of Jewish history. If there's the idea that somebody gets to stay in the same place his entire career is his entire career, like Derek Jeter, right? The idea that somebody—it's becoming less and less likely that somebody gets to yeah, you know, he lived in America, right? He was born, he lived, you know, until he was 95 and lived in America his entire life. It's very rare in Jewish history in general, and especially during this time. So there's much turmoil over the course of his life, and I bring that up because if this is indeed an accurate picture, at least a somewhat accurate picture, the notion that somebody in his 40s might actually look like he's in his 60s or 70s doesn't seem, when we learn about his life and the amount of heartache and difficulty that he went through and some of the things that he wrote, it may not seem like such a wild possibility. But again, take it with a grain of salt. We don't know that this is him, but certainly looks scholarly and, you know, sagacious enough perhaps to be. A little geography. So we've moved into Eastern Europe, which we discussed a little bit last time when we were dealing with the Ramah and the Ramah's interaction with Rav Yosef Karo, right? The Ramah, Rav Moshe Isserles, wrote all of the Ashkenazic glosses to the Shulchan Aruch so that it became a work that was usable for Ashkenazim as well, and not only Sephardim, but nevertheless, bowing in deference to the command and scholarship of Rav Yosef Karo, left it at that, just the Mapa L'Shulchan, just a handful of notes on Rav Yosef Karo's Shulchan Aruch. So we were in this area of the globe a little bit last time for that reason, but we've really moved away from where Rav Yosef Karo spent most of his life, which was in the Ottoman Empire and then in the Middle East. We're not that far off, because if you move just slightly east of this map, we saw that there was a period of time when Rav Yosef Karo was living in the southern, sort of the southeastern Ukraine, which was actually under the control of the Ottoman Empire at the time. This, though, is very, very much classical Eastern Europe. These lines that are drawn between Czechoslovakia or the Czech Republic and Poland and Belarus and Lithuania, these are fluid. These are rather fluid. The lines that you see here are the lines that, as they exist today. But trying to figure out where any given town or shtetl falls at any at any point of Jewish history becomes a little bit more of a difficult problem. So the lines are somewhat fluid, but this general world of, you know, Poland and Lithuania is basically where we are. So where does the Shach actually grow up? He's born likely somewhere either in or around Vilna, some different accounts, if he was born in Vilna proper or some smaller shtetl just outside, but someplace around there, someplace around Vilna. Vilna is already a major hub of Jewish activity. That's where he grows up. His first Rebbe is his father. This is sort of the same old story. We noted the same with Rav Yosef Karo. Remember that in general, there's not the typical yeshiva system as it exists presently. We are very, very far off from any sort of real institutionalized yeshiva movement. So he's learning under his father. His father, from a very, very early age, realizes that he has something extraordinarily special on his hands in his son. His son is, I mean, you know the story. He's a child prodigy. He's absolutely brilliant. His mastery of halacha and his insight, and et cetera, et cetera. And all of that, as well as his bekiyus and his retention and his ability to remember and all of that. So what do you do with a kid when you realize that he's more than you can necessarily offer? So he sends him off to Tiktin. Tiktin is a small town. This is the second little flag here in northeastern Poland. That is much larger from a Jewish perspective during this time in the 17th century than we know of it, obviously, to be today. But that's where he sends him to. He sends him there to learn under Rav Yoshua Heschel ben Rav Yosef. We're right at the cusp of last names here, by the way. So some will have and some won't have. It's interesting. Even the Shach sometimes has his... It's not really a let. We only know him as Rav Shabsai HaKohen. Sometimes you see, even in his own signature, he'll sign his name as Rav Shabsai Kuf Tzadi, like what we would today say Katz, but he may very well just have been saying Kohen Tzedek, the same way that instead of writing HaKohen, you might write Kohen Tzedek. So this sort of evolves into a last name. Some of the major players during this period of time have last names that we still know about, some sort of yes, some sort of no. But at any rate, he sends him to go learn with this Rav Yoshua Heschel ben Rav Yosef, who's the Rav of Tiktin, who also is the author, I'm just going to skip to this for 1 second, he's the author of a work called Magine Shlomo. Magine Shlomo is a collection of ha'aros on a range of different mesechtos throughout Shas. So it's not strictly speaking a halachic work, it's sort of a commentary on Shas. This happens to be a title page that I picked up on Hebrew Books. This is a rather contemporary title, but I think this is from like a 19th century print, late 19th century printing or something like that. But you'll see this Sefer Magine Shlomo is Chidush Halachos Chidushim Rabim, tremendous novella on Shas, Devarim Atikin, Misukin, Harifin, Al Gemara, Pirushet Tosfos, Al Masech Shabbos, Psachim, Beitza, Yevamos, Ksubis, Kedushin, Bavakam, Achulin, a variety of Masechtos of Shas, Asher Chibur Hagon Hagadol Hamafursam, Moreno Harav Rabbeinu Yehoshua Zal, Shahaya Av Bezdin, Bekihilas Kodesh, Krakow. Krakow, so that's a problem. It's a problem because, if we backtrack here for a second, so really the Shach, right, Rav Shabsai, little Rav Shabsai, he sends to learn in Tiktin up here in northeastern Poland, and then it says on this title page of the Magine Shlomo that the author is the Av Beis Din of Krakow. So that's exactly what happens. He receives this post. Krakow is a major, major Jewish community. This is where the Ramah lived just a short while earlier, Rav Moshe Isserles, we spoke about last time a little bit. So when he gets the call to go be the Rosh Yeshiva, basically, of Krakow, or the Av Beis Din of Krakow, those two lines are also blurred, by the way, Av Beis Din and the Rav of the community and the Rosh Yeshiva, because there isn't the sort of formal, you know, yeshiva system to the same degree, not yet, and even, you don't even have to look so far as you know, the actual founding of what we call the yeshiva movement today from Rav Chaim Voloshiner, but this was sort of how it was. You found a particular Rebbe, you went to his community, you learned with him, and he had a whole host of responsibilities and duties in that community. So Rav Yoshua Heschel gets the call to go to Krakow. What does he do? He takes his prize Talmud with him. That's how they both end up there. So far, this is quite the expanse even thus far. Rav Shabsai HaKohen is born somewhere in and around Vilna. He ends up in northeastern Poland here in Tiktin, and then ends up moving down to Krakow, all the while trying to follow the path that his father first sets him on, and then following his Rebbe to be able to learn. Where does he go from Krakow? He goes back to Vilna. Why would you go back home after you've spent time in yeshiva? Everything's going well, and you're spending time in yeshiva, and you're learning. Why would you ever go back to your hometown? Why would you ever go back home? Why do kids go back home after yeshiva? His father said, that's a great answer. Answer number one. Money and?
He had to do his laundry.
Shidduch. Money and shidduch. Those go hand in hand. You don't need money until you don't really need money until you need a shidduch. And you can't necessarily have a shidduch until you have money. So fortunately, the shidduch is made for both all at the same time. He goes back to Vilna, and this is now like the he's the celebrity of Vilna, right? This is the kid who made it big. He's the child prodigy. Everybody knew about him, and he went off to Tiktin, and then he followed his Rebbe, and his Rebbe took him to this important post at Krakow. And wow, he's gone off, and he's seen the world, and now he's coming back to Vilna. So obviously the greatest gvir in Vilna, Rav Shimon Wolf, wants him as his son-in-law, and so it happens. So it happens that he ends up marrying the daughter of this very, very wealthy gvir, this very wealthy, philanthropist and baal tzedakah, if you will. And more than tzedakah, he's supporting his son-in-law. He sees a tremendous future for Rav Shabtai Cohen, and he has the means, and he's supporting him, and he's continuing to learn there in Vilna. I've seen some different accounts of what exactly happens next. But near as I can tell, the following it seems to resonate and seems to make more sense of some of the things that I came across. He's there in Vilna, and in Vilna he stays. There's going to be disaster that strikes. Just before disaster strikes, though, first of all, while there, he then gets an appointment. This is now back. I'm sorry. This is not in Vilna. This is now back in Krakow. This is where part of the difficulty arises. While in Vilna, he is not only learning, but he actually receives something of a shteller. He's invited to become part of the Beis Din of Rav Moshe Lima. Rav Moshe Lima wrote a sefer called the Chalkas Mechokek that we don't really know is its own sefer anymore. We now know this as one of the commentaries on the Shulchan Aruch, specifically on Shulchan Aruch Eben HaEzer. If you buy a Shulchan Aruch in a store today, and you open it up to Eben HaEzer, the beginning of Eben HaEzer, the Chalkas Mechokek is one of the commentaries that flanks the Shulchan Aruch, much like ultimately the Shach will do in his own, the volumes that he actually comments on. So the same way that you buy a Chumash today, you open up the Chumash in the bottom, you're going to find the Rashi. So you open up a Shulchan Aruch to Eben HaEzer, and the Chalkas Mechokek is there. This is a very, very prominent position. It's someplace around down at the bottom here. That here is the Av Bezdin B'Kehila Mifuara Kehilas Kodesh Vilna. This is where the Shach is, and this is where he receives this this particular shteller. In 1647, still presumably, one account has this happening in Krakow, and then other accounts that I've read happen in Vilna. This is where, I don't know if the actual source material is confused, but this is at least where I find things somewhat confusing. But at any rate, this does happen here. Right before the disaster actually strikes is the publication of basically what becomes his name. Right. We really rarely call him Rav Shabtai HaKohen. We rarely even call him the Sifsei Kohen. We call him the Shach. Right? Like all, or not like all, but like many, many Sfarim that have been, condensed down to just their Rashi Tevos. So the Sifsei Kohen, Shin Chaf, becomes the Shach. He writes a masterful, masterful work on the Shulchan Aruch, specifically on Yoredeya. So Yoredeya deals with Isser Veheter. It deals with things like kashrus, basar bechalav, and taruvos, and forbidden mixtures, and nida, and all kinds of things that we interact with in our daily lives. And he writes just an absolutely masterful perush on Shulchan Aruch. One of the things that is that needs to be taken note of, that we sort of touched on a little bit last time when we were speaking about Rav Yosef Cairo, is that it was never necessarily a foregone conclusion that the Shulchan Aruch is going to be it. Right? Like, we sort of, when we look back on the way that these things actually unfold, it would be mistaken to view everything as being Har Sinai. Right? Har Sinai happens as an event in Jewish history, the Mishnayos. Right? Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi has the power and the clout and the muscle and the connections to say that we're going to publish the Mishnah, and the Mishnah is going to be it. Like, everybody's just going to be learning Mishnah, and this is going to be the standard text. There also are no other texts at the time, right? Har Sinai happens, and the Chumash is it. And Chazal got together, and they say, this is what we're going to canonize, and this is what we're not going to canonize. This is going to be part of Tanakh, and this is not going to be part of Tanakh. It's going to be 24 books, and that's going to be it. And this is going to be the text that everybody studies. And even so, undoubtedly, there are things, at least at some points of history, and depending on which particular splinter sect you're working with, it's never easy to move those kinds of things across completely. But all the more so when it comes to even a great gadol and even a great gaon and somebody who everybody looks to as being a very important authority. It's one thing to be an important authority, and it's another thing to become the authority. The Shulchan Aruch becomes the authority. So that's due in no small part to the fact that the Ramah also signs off on it. Right? The fact that the Shulchan Aruch writes his magnum opus, really his magnum opus is the Beis Yosef, but then writes the Shulchan Aruch, the fact that the Ramah afterwards signs off on it by saying that I'm going to include and incorporate my own thoughts, my own ideas, my own Piskei Halacha into your work is a huge, not just vote of confidence, but it creates a certain usability for the consumer, if you will. Right? It pays for me now to actually have the Shulchan Aruch, to look at the Shulchan Aruch, because it's not only Sephardic Halacha, now it's also Ashkenazic Halacha. Even so, there was the Bayis Chadash, which was another commentary that was written on the tour that argued with the Beis Yosef, right? Rav Yosef Karo's first work on the tour. There, we spoke a little bit, I think, about Rav Mordechai Yaffa last time, who wrote the Levush, which was sort of like an alternate Shulchan Aruch, almost. There was the Maharshal, Rav Shlomo Luria, who wrote his work as well. It was by no means a slam dunk that the Shulchan Aruch was going to become the text that all of Klal Yisrael was going to use. Like Rav Yosef Karo got up in his shul one day and he gave a clap on the bima and said, from now on, everybody, all of Klal Yisrael, without question, this is going to be the sefer that everybody buys that they have on their shelf. So how does it happen? The Ramah helps it out tremendously, but the later commentators also help it out tremendously. There's no rule that stated at the time that the Sifsei Kohen, that Rav Shabsai HaKohen, had to write a commentary to the Shulchan Aruch as opposed to just writing his own work on that was independent of any other sefer. Here are my Piskei Halacha, here's what I decide, and this is what I do. And it's not necessarily attached to the Shulchan Aruch. The fact that he does attach it means that now it continues the paper trail that all leads back to the Shulchan Aruch, and again, it gives it that much more clout, even as he argues. Right, so the Shach actually comes under some fire, and he talks about it in his introduction, which I think it's worthwhile to see. But the Shach actually comes under fire to a degree for arguing with the Shulchan Aruch and the Ramah. Like, well, that's what you thought, but I have my idea, and this is what I think. And at the end, when we actually see a psak of his, we'll see that to an even greater degree. But you want to give us a quick pass out just to see a few lines of his. Hakdamos don't get enough time. The preface to any sefer is enormously helpful in trying to get a real sense of what exactly is taking place in the pages therein. Very, very, very worthwhile. So here's what he says. He actually notes that he's going to, he does so humbly, but he notes that, it's like that he's going to come out firing. If you take a look, and I'm sorry that some of this got, sort of blackened in on the margins there. So this middle section, what he has at the beginning is very interesting. It's very cute. Actually, he incorporates his own name, or at least the letters of his own name, into a poem that he, again, starting to show some of his mastery of the Hebrew language also, and then another additional poem at the bottom. But in the middle, we have some more meat. Amar HaMechaber, here's what the author says. This is the introduction of the Shach, of Rav Shabsai HaKohen, to his Sifsei Kohen. Amar HaMechaber, So says the author. As Hashem Elokim befi oso adaber, whatever God has placed in my mouth, so shall I speak. Belashon katzar, and I'll try to do it as concisely as possible. He's describing his sefer, right? That I'm going to try to convey as much content as I can, as much meat as possible, in as concise a language as I can. V'kal, and as light a lashon as possible, as light a language and terminology as possible. U'manyeh l'navon nakel, u'basi l'hodia l'chol asher sifri zeh elav yagia, ki lo chibarti chibur halaz l'hagis libi behora'a. He says that I'm doing this really for the benefit of the reader, and it's not l'hagis libi behora'a, it's not in order to for me to be to become arrogant, for me to laud myself over others by my issuing my own psak and my own decision. V'lomar, in order to say kiblu daiti, that you should just accept what I say. Shehein reshaim, the truth is that everyone else is really permitted to have an opinion. V'loani, but not me. Why? Ki tzair anochi liyamim, after all, I'm very young. I don't know if you were doing the math at all. The shach is somewhere around 24 years old when he writes this. It's absolutely astonishing. 24 years old when he writes a complete, comprehensive, running commentary on all of Yoredeya, that then, like everybody else, uses to be able to actually get smicha. Al kain zechalti vayir, so I'm crying and I'm afraid, ki aruma nochi b'da'as bazui, because I'm completely, I'm unclothed, I'm naked, I have no das of my own. Im tolas, so I'm worm ridden, velo ish, I'm not even a real man compared to all of the figures that I'm trying to argue with.
He's not married yet?
He's married. He is married at this point. Af 24. Af haboba emes ube tamim tarachti tarachos harbe. He says I've exerted such effort with this. V'kami yegios yagati, that I've exerted such toil. Lo asakti b'shum esek acher. This was my singular focus. I did nothing else. Lo nasati shena le'enai, usnumala afaypai. I gave my eyes no sleep, no slumber. Shanim rabos, for many years. Ad asher hotzesi oso el hakoach el hapo. I'm sorry, I got cut off here. Until I've been able to bring that which I had thought about, right, just the potential, into an actual work, into actual form. Machshavti uberarti v'shakalti hakol b'kaf mozayim v'chazarti hakol tzedodim v'tzidei tzedodim, and I've turned over every rock, and I've analyzed every side and every dimension. Lo pamachas ushtayim ki mea pa'amim ve'echad. I've analyzed, I've looked everything over 101 times. There is nothing in this sefer that's written off the cuff. Im chaverim chashuvim achuvim chavivim ve'aravim. And I've also enlisted the help of my friends and my colleagues and people that I could trust. Hamakshivim lekoli, who would bother spending the time listening to my voice. And anybody who wasn't in my camp, meaning anybody who didn't agree with me, you wouldn't even believe the amount of effort that I exerted delving into the Yam HaTalmud, into the Gemara, and into the Rishonim, etc., etc. The Aposkim Aki HaAmati HaKol Al Burya, until I was able to set everything properly. So I came up with some idea, and I brought it to one of my friends, one of my chaverim. I sent off a letter, and the response came back, and he said, I don't really like what you've written here. What about this sugya? What about that? What about this gemara? What about the Rambam says? And it drove me crazy until I could finally figure out what exactly the MS was, and that's what I have published here. Im kol ze yadati ne'amana ki efshar levar below tevin. Even so, I know it's impossible to ever produce grain without straw. There's always some chaff mixed in. It's a very, very humble... I mean, it's astonishing to spend that much time on something and say, now it's ready for print, without a shred of arrogance. I'm sure I made mistakes, and I'm sure that there are errors, and I'm sure it could still be better with all the difficulty and all the efforts that I've actually been through. Nevertheless, I'm sure it's happened. Vashkios miyavin, who can know the number of errors that maybe have sunk in here? And what he basically goes on to say is that he implores anybody who reads this to inform him. Right, if you see any mistakes, right, if there are any difficulties, if there are any problems, then please, by all means, bring them to my attention. The only thing that he makes a point of asking is that they actually make a case, meaning not just to whine and to scream and to shout, but to actually do something, but to actually come up with some sort of counterposition. He says. I'm going to continue on the same line for just a second because there's another point here as well. So he says, L'chol korei b'sifri, anybody who reads my sefer, zeh sha'al... Not sure it's all rubbed out. Apiske v'harasi v'echrati ki ein talmid kamoni machria ben aharim gedolim haga'onim. How can I possibly insert myself between the two giants, between the two mountains of Moreno Harav Yosef Karo or Moreno Harav Moshe Esulus? He says an interesting thing. Chami zikni, right? Which is like my father-in-law, my grandfather. It was his father-in-law's grandfather. The Ramah was his father, and he married into the Ramah's mishpacha. So there's tremendous deference here that on the one hand he's giving them, but at the same time he's also intimating that there are going to be times that he doesn't just bow to their opinion purely per se, just because they are who they are. So there's a lot that there's going to be some flack that he takes for this, and he basically says that, you know, I haven't come here just in order to get into a fight. But if anybody does want to start a fight, then please just do so in an appropriate sort of way. Position paper, let me know about it, let's talk about it, let's hash this out. And he sort of implores the audience also to not just pay attention to all the noise. I mean, just because people are getting up and screaming and shouting, you have to really tell them to, ask them to make a point, ask them to actually explain it, to actually bring a raya, and to say it's because of this, and this, that, and the other thing. So there's a certain measure of confidence, but there's also a tremendous measure of humility that goes into this. We'll flip to the back page of this in just a second. But what happens in the exact same year is, get back into this, happens the exact same year, as you can see on the sort of the other side of this page. So this is what a standard Shulchan Aruch looks like if you buy it today. Shach on the one side, and the Turei Zahav, the Taz, on the other side. The Taz was written by Rav David Halevi Segel, who was slightly older than the Shach, but they lived at the same time. The same year that the Shach was published, the Turei Zahav was also published. And the Taz came sort of fighting back against much of what the Shach wrote. Some direct, some less so. Maybe some... Yeah.
More so agreeing with the Shulchan Aruch.
Sometimes defending the Shulchan Aruch, taking others to task. It's amazing. The Taz often quotes his father-in-law. His father-in-law was the Bach, the Bayis Chadash, who wrote the other commentary, standard commentary on the Tur that argues with the Beis Yosef. This is, you know, this is what's going on right now. He often quotes the Bach, his father-in-law. He often argues with his father-in-law. I don't know how that works out in terms of being supported. I don't know how that all that plays out. But at any rate, he often says, quotes, Mem Vav Ches Mori Chami, my father-in-law, my master. So again, with a great deal of respect, but also sometimes argues. But the Taz, it seems, takes some issue with the degree to which the Shach argues on the Shulchan Aruch and the Ramah, perhaps. The Shach comes firing back on the Taz. So the Shach writes his Sefer. The Taz's Sefer is published immediately. Now, these things don't happen overnight. You know, you don't just like wake up one day and think, I think I'll write a comprehensive commentary in Yoredeya today. Tomorrow, ice skating. Yeah, these things take like a lot of time. As you see, I mean, when the Shach writes about his own work, he says, I can't tell you how many sleepless nights for years on end I went through and polling and quizzing and asking and inquiring of other Rabbanim, etc., etc. So they happen to be published the same year, but the Shach does come firing back. The Shach writes a sefer called Nekudos HaKesef. It's like, you're writing the Turei Zahav, so I'm writing the Nekudos HaKesef. Yours is gold, but mine is silver, and silver is somehow better than gold, whatever it is. It's basically to sort of poke holes in the Taz. It's running commentary on the Taz on Yoredeya. Again, any standard edition of the Shulchan Aruch, Shach on this side, Taz on this side, and the Nekudos HaKesef among other Perushim here in the margins as well, which we'll get to in a little bit. The only thing that I wanted to point out from the from this Hakdama, from this preface to the Nekudos HaKesef, think two items. One is that there was a meeting at some point, and number two is that, again, he wants to be clear that he doesn't have any beef with the Taz. right? This isn't like some, you know, vendetta that he has against the Taz, and this is why I'm writing a nasty commentary against him. It's just, this is how Torah works. This is how halacha works. I'm defending my position, and I'm attacking some of his positions. This is how you ultimately get to MS. He says in this middle paragraph here, Hakdamas Hagon Hashach Zal Lesifro Nekudos HaKesef. This is his introduction to his Sefer Nekudos HaKesef, which was written on the Taz, on the Taz's work. Amar HaMechaber, author says as follows, Al Yal, he starts off with an apology. It's sort of like, he's not really going in swinging, even though the content of his work is going to be that. Al Yal Alev HaKore B'Sifri Zeh. Anyone who's reading my Sefer shouldn't think that because, God forbid, I had Eza Machlokas Im Habal to Rezahav, that I've had some kind of Machlokas with him. Like, he never invited me to his grandson's bar mitzvah, and it's been eating me up inside ever since. I'm going to write the nastiest commentary again. I'm going to make him look like such a fool. Anybody who buys a Shulchan Aruch from here on out is going to know that I'm a bigger Talmud Chacham than he. That's not where this is coming from. Oh, Yeshli Belibi Ezotina Alav, that I have some Bregus or some quarrel against him. Chibarti Hasagos HaSefer, that's why I compiled all these notes on his Sefer, that I'm trying to poke holes in his Sefer. Ki halo no de la kol, ki niskayim banu es vahev besufa v'atorah machzeres achar achsanya. Shalad, it's such a gemara in Bava Metzia. He's saying that it's a very cute sort of notion. The idea of Hatorah machzeres achar achsanya shalah is that that anybody who plays host to the Torah, so the Torah won't depart. There will always be that relationship there with the Torah. The Gemara in Bava Metzia is using it to show that there's going to be sort of a relationship with the Torah for all future generations. If I serve as host to the Torah, because I'm studying it, then, you know, your kids and your grandkids and your great-grandkids, they're all going to have it too. So he says, no, but quite literally, Shena'asisi achsanya lebala tureisav. One day he was passing through town and I got to play host to the Taz. The Taz stayed with me, right? We pulled out the trundle from under the kid's bed and everything, and I like put up the coffee in the morning. Vayetzli shlosh yom, he stayed with me for 3 days. V'chibadtiv kavod gadol asher lo yu'uman ki yisuper. You would not believe how I treated him. I was at his every beck and call, and I waited on him hand and foot, and I was there for him. I did everything. I showed him such kavod. V'gam hunis kabe biharbe, and he also gave me great honor. Ad sheni shakni al roshi, he kissed me on my head. It's just a sweet thing, like to think that there was this meeting between these two great gaonim. The samach bimamish kesimchas beis hashoeva, and such a tremendous simcha that he had when he was staying in my house to be in my presence and I to be in his presence. Such a beautiful thing. So his point is that, again, I'm not writing this because I'm just trying to poke holes. Just for the sake of doing so, or just for the sake of some vendetta that I have against the Taz, Chas v'Shalom. We've met, we love, hugs and kisses. This is how Torah works. The Taz writes a commentary, fires back on the Nekudos HaKesef, and then the Shach fires back on that. The Taz writes...
How old was the Shach when he wrote the Nekudos HaKesef?
I don't know when it was actually published. Some of the Shach's stuff doesn't come out until... I believe it was shortly thereafter. One of the if the Taz is written in the same year as the Shach, I believe it was soon thereafter. Some of the Shach's stuff only comes out posthumously. It's put out by his child or grandson. But I believe the Nekudos HaKesef comes out shortly after the Taz is published, which means it would have been shortly after. And there's enough time for a whole back and forth.
The Shach also could have been, like, the Taz could have been written as the Shach was running, because he said, like, he asked his colleagues... And he passed whatever.
Must have been. It must have been. There's writing, no.
It's like, it's too much.
There's no way it could come out in the same year. Cause it was like, I can't believe he wrote this. I'm gonna get, you know, like, now I'm gonna write this whole. That's it. We're gonna have to go to, you know, Miami next week, because this weekend I have to write the Taz. I know they tell the story about the. Not the rugged. Well, no, about the there are those stories also about the Balaturim on Chumash, right? That. Allegedly, the story goes that the tour, Rav Yaakov ben Asher, right? This was Rabbeinu Asher, the Rosh, a great gon of the period of the Rishonim. His son says, I want to write a work on halacha. And his father tells him, can't write a work on halacha. You haven't even written a work on Chumash. So he stays up that night and he writes the Baal HaTurim. And then he says, like, will this do? He says, yeah, that'll do. and then he proceeds to write the tour. I don't know. I can tell you this much. They don't say those things about me. So, you know, that in of itself is very illustrative of the kind of person that he was. But at any rate, there's absolutely all these things take longer. The Negudo Sekesef does not take as long, right? It can be a much quicker fire back, right? They're simple, short, you know, ha'aros. Sometimes defending himself and sometimes not. We'll see a very interesting example, very telling example at the end. But onwards and upwards. So again, the fact that this all takes place involving the Shulchan Aruch very much cements the Shulchan Aruch and the Ramah again and again and again as really the preeminent halachic authorities that everybody's going to turn to first and foremost. You know, if imitation is the highest form of flattery, then I guess, you know, argument is the second highest form of flattery. You don't argue with someone that you don't respect. Right, so the fact that the argument exists indicates that I care enough about your position because you're important enough that I will bother arguing with you, even if I don't necessarily agree. The Shach and the Taz really cement the fact that for all time people are going to be learning the Shulchan Aruch. Immediately afterwards, and the Shach is still writing. The Shach is still producing. The Shach is still writing. He's in Av Bezdin in Vilna. Immediately afterwards come the Khmelnytsky pogroms, the Khmelnytsky uprising. This is a portrait of Bogdan Khmelnytsky. He's a nasty, nasty, nasty human being. He's a Ukrainian hero. This is a Ukrainian Cossack uprising. He's still remembered as something of a hero for, you know, liberating the poor and oppressed of Eastern Europe, of Ukraine and you know, Lithuania and Poland from their overlords. The Jews get mixed up in the whole thing. They get mixed up in the whole thing in part because it doesn't take much for a marauding, bloodthirsty band of would-be pogromniks, basically, who are already torching and looting everything that they see in their path to also take out all their aggression on the Jew. The Jew has always been a scapegoat, especially in this part of the world. But has always been the scapegoat. But there is a little bit more to it than that. Part of the uprising is the uprising against the, you know, inequality of here we are working our tails off when we don't see a cut of the action, right? I'm a peasant working on somebody's field. I don't even, you know, I don't own it. I can't own it. There's nothing I can do to ever break out of that, of this cycle. And who actually owns the lands, or who's standing as the middleman financing the whole relationship, are the Jews and the Jewish bankers and all of that. So all the Jewish communities basically everywhere in this entire area of the world, while these pogroms are taking place, while the uprising is taking place, immediately become the sites of heinous, heinous, vicious pogroms. Vilna is one such site. There are pogroms all over the place. The Nemirov pogrom is a very, and the massacre that occurs there is a very well-known one, one that the Shach writes about. The reason why this needs to be brought up is, first of all, because this is what first puts the Shach on the lam, right? Like anybody else who's actually able to survive and run and hide, the Shach is one of those survivors and runners and hiders, and he goes from Vilna, where he was again in the Av Bezdin, in the Bezdin, serving as a member of the Bezdin with Chalkas Mechokek, as we spoke about before. This is where his wife was, this is where his family was. So he runs and he ends up in Lublin. He's in Lublin for something like all of 3 months before the next pogrom finds its way there, and he like narrowly escapes. I mean, just by the hair of his chin, is able to get out of Lublin, and then it's from there it's basically to Czechoslovakia, where he basically takes up, he becomes, starts all over again and takes up the position of Rabbanus in Prague first, very, very briefly, and then moves around all within Czechoslovakia and basically stays there for the rest of his life, because the rest of this area is at this point effectively Judenrein. It's just an extremely dangerous place to be. These pogroms are what we refer to in Hebrew as the Gezeros Tach V'Tat, not Gezeros as in like, you know, the Greek from Chazal, but sort of like Gezerah Min HaShemayim, like Kra Roa Gezar Dinenu, that these are these horrible decrees that befell the Jews in the years of Tach V'Tat, which amount to 1648 and 1649. Horrible, horrible pogrom. So he hadn't known anything most heinous since the time of the Crusades, and the most heinous until the Holocaust, unfortunately, just to put it in some very broad kind of perspective.
Isn't there anything that we inserted to davening because of this?
Yes, there are kinos that are written. Not only are there kinos written that are actually incorporated.
This is a period that we don't say slichos, but because of this we say
slichos. Yeah, I don't know that there are any kinos that are actually incorporated into. That's during the Crusades. You might be thinking of the Crusades. We don't say avarachimim typically. We wouldn't ordinarily say tachanun if we're not saying. I'm sorry, avarachimim if we're not saying tachanun, but then during the Yumei Sphere we do because it's when the Crusades took place. But there are certain kinos that are authored that are written about the Chmelnytsky pogroms in different cities and in different towns. The Shach actually writes, it's a fascinating work. It reads something like an historical account, something like a kina. He actually writes a separate kina. As a total aside, the 20th of Sivan, which I believe was the day of the Nemrov massacre, I believe, becomes, which was one of the most brutal of all the pogroms in this whole Chmelnytsky period, actually becomes in certain communities a day of fast. It's an extra Yom Tzom, Yom Tinus. It's like an extra Tisha B'Av. It's like sort of like an extra Yom HaShoah, I guess, Lahavdil somehow or another. An extra day. Again, you can imagine with all the same halachic debate that surrounds any attempt to institute a day of mourning and avelos apart from Tisha B'Av. But that's what happens. The Shach, again, in addition to writing these kinos, also writes, just to have a brief sampling, I mean, it's a fascinating, it's horrible and tragic. This is a very, very quick piece that I think historically is sort of interesting. It sort of raises an eyebrow to a degree, but just to have a little taste of what's happening here. So the Shach, on the heels of this, writes the Megillas Eifa, which again is an account of what happened to some of the different communities, what was taking place, and the political turmoil and all of that, and how all the aggression was taken out on the Jews. Here's what he says. This is like just someplace I kind of was flipping through and pulled out a few paragraphs at random. And just note that it's written as a rhyme, which is sort of remarkable. Again, it sort of reads as a kina, but sort of certainly longer than that. V'az dibru harekim el hayehudim devarm tovim v'nichumim. So then the Rekim, the empty ones, he's talking about the Cossacks of the people, the angry mob, turned to the Jews and they spoke things that were comforting, pleasant words. Lama tiyunech nakam v'nishchatim kfar ben bakar tamim. Why should you be put to death? Why should, they're like cajoling them. What they mean is, why should we kill you, right? Why should we murder you in cold? Why would you bother have us murder you in cold blood? Really, it's about your God. Your God is pouring out your blood without any mercy whatsoever. And if your God is doing this to you, so instead, why don't you serve our God? And why don't you serve our idols? And why don't you bow down to our images? And instead, we'll all be as one. The reason why I say that historically this is sort of interesting is because this wasn't really a religious war. Right, this wasn't like a crusade, and this wasn't an inquisition, and this wasn't an intifada. This wasn't about religion. This was about a like political uprising, and we're going to take out our aggression on the Jews. But again, so is this sort of like the same way that we read the Asar Haruge Malchus, we read about the 10 martyrs on Yom Kippur. It's a poetic account more than it's a historical account. It's meant to tug at the heartstrings, and it sort of incorporates other themes of Jewish anti-Semitism and Jewish blood being spilled all throughout the generations into this flowing narrative of the Asar Haruge Malchus that isn't entirely historical. I don't know if that's in part what this is, or if indeed there were accounts of, quite literally, there being these challenges that were made. And why don't we just all be one, right? You'll become baptized and you'll be like us, and then we won't have to. You have to understand, as you are, we have to kill you in cold blood. If you could just do yourselves a favor, then we wouldn't have to anymore. And then you could all live, and you'd be free of all of the persecution. And we return all your property to you. And you'd be rich. You'd be officers, and you'd have such high-ranking positions. And Here's what happens. All the different people, all the different groups of the Jews got together. They all gathered together, the old, the small, the rich, the poor, etc. All of these people that had no mum, right? There's already the expression of serving as a karban. Right? They had no mum. They were completely unblemished. They were perfect. They'd never done anything wrong. And now effectively they're going to be taken as sacrifices. And they called out with a great outcry and a bitter outcry to HaKadosh Baruch Hu above, Shema Yisrael Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad. Ki Alecha Huragnu Kol Hayom Hashem Elokei Yisrael Havasimim. We're going to be killed on your behalf. Lo Nashevim Misei Shav Lo Navo Im Na'alamim. We're not going to be to sit amongst these abandoned ones, these low-lives. And instead they clap al chait and they say that we're guilty, it's our fault, we brought this upon ourselves somehow. They recite Siddiq Hadin, they say, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, you're perfect, whatever you do, there's a reason. And they let out their cries and they called out to HaKadosh Baruch Hu in heaven. And then the low life pogromniks, they turn all of their wrath and aggression on the Jews. I was working on this shiur and then I came up for dinner. Everybody sitting around the table. I said, like, guys, we have to be so makir tov just for living in the generation that we do. Which is totally accidental, which is not something that we deserve, ki huzeh, but this is how most of Jewish history reads. I don't mean to turn the evening into Tisha B'Av, but this is how most of Jewish history reads, and the level of appreciation that we need to have for HaKadosh Baruch Hu, just that we get up in the morning, and, you know, it was a bad day. Why was it a bad day? It's the yatz in the cubicle next to me. It was, you know, firstly, told me some stupid joke at the water cooler. He's a pain in the neck. That's number one. And then I stubbed my toe on the way back. And then I forgot to get gas in New Jersey, so I had to get in Pennsylvania. And I know that it's basically, but now it's still like an extra, 75 cents. It was just a lousy day. And I forgot my Easy Pass. So they're going to send me the letter in the mail, and I'm going to have to send them a photocopy of my Easy Pass thing so that I can, it's just whatever. I don't want to talk about it. It's a lousy day. I mean, that's a lousy day. That's a lousy day. And what's remarkable is that, A, to us, that this is a lousy day, and the degree to which we have to put that all in perspective, number one. And number two, that this is the background. This is the backdrop against which the Shach and the Taz live. And what they do is they run from place to place, fearful for their lives, that the Shach is able to have the fortitude to actually produce something like this, to write with pride that we didn't give up, that we didn't just give in, that we didn't just bow our heads, that we know what's right and what's wrong, that he can sit and bring pen to paper and talk about how, Kadosh Baruch Hu, whatever you do is right, and we as martyrs know that, and even as he's running for his life, he's in Lublin for 3 months and he has to turn around and run off to Czechoslovakia, how far away is he from anything that he's ever known before? And by the way, he also picks up the Rabbanus again, and he's still there trying to teach, and he's still there writing, and he's perfecting a manuscript for Sifsei Kohen on Choshen Mishpat that's not even going to come out until he dies, and he's writing on the Sugi of Takfo Kohen, and he's writing on the Rambam's Sefer HaMitzvos, and he's writing, and he's teaching, and he's teaching, even though he has ostensibly every reason in the world to say, I'm so done with this whole thing. And it's an absolutely remarkable testament to what it means to be educated and an educator and try to spread the good word, even though everything is telling you to just abandon it and kind of run for the hills. It's an amazing, amazing personality, and to consider then that he's able to produce what he does and live the life that he does, even against that backdrop, is something that's absolutely incredible. The final word on the Shach is just that he spends the rest of his life in Czechoslovakia. He has a few very brief stop in Prague, but essentially settles it towards the end of his life in the Moravia area of Czechoslovakia, and that's where he lives out the remainder of his life. He has a far better relationship with the Gentile class around him. He's actually very tight with some of the political figures there. And I guess, all in all, lives peacefully, for the rest of his life, but dies a very, very young man. And all of the accounts of everything that took place is just he's never the same. How can you? How can you be the same after this? We don't have a great record of, you know, the name of every extremely close personal tie, friend, cousin, aunt, nephew, niece, parents, in-laws, who knows, that he lost in all of this chaos. The numbers were staggering, startling. There are many accounts of this. The Shach is one of the most horrible, tragic, comprehensive, maybe even. But it's, again, just an absolutely remarkable thing that living in this area of the world, at this time of Jewish history, that somebody can be as prolific an author and be as successful a posek and an author and all of that is absolutely, absolutely remarkable. As a final piece, what I wanted to share with you is, that's the Life and Times. But as far as Torah, I think this is very telling, in terms of subject matter, I guess, on the one hand, but also just in terms of there being, I almost want to say, like a perhaps a bit of passive-aggressive sentiment from the Taz to the Shach, and then sort of from the Shach a little bit ratcheting it up back to the Taz. And again, I mean all of that on as high a level as possible, as is indicated by the Shach himself.
Was he like sick or something? Or
I mean, it must have been. I don't think he was murdered. I don't think it was an accident. I think he...
42, 43.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, very, very young man. I mean, even by those standards. Even by those standards. Very, very young. What's going on here, if you... So, again, standard Shulchan Aruch, if you're not totally familiar, and pardon all the underlines and notes and whatever that aren't relevant for tonight. But smack in the middle is the Shulchan Aruch with the Ramah. Right? The Ramah is written smaller. The Ramah is typically written in a Rashi-style script. So this is Pei Zayin. This is the very beginning of Hilchos Basar B'Chalav. And something that I think resonates today, there's generally less concern with this today. We'll see the halacha, and then you'll won't all be so you know, esoteric. But if you jump to the Ramah, right in the middle of the page, the Ramah says as follows. The Shulchan Aruch is basically discussing the difference between what is Basar B'Chalav on a De'oraisa level, and then what's Basar B'Chalav on a De'rabbanan level, and what are some of the distinctions that need to be made between the two, right? What does the Torah actually indicate is prohibited? And then what do the rabbis later on say is prohibited? So the Ramah says an interesting thing. V'nahagu lasos chalav mishkedim. So there's this idea of making milk out of almonds. Right? This is in vogue again. They didn't have soybeans. Umanichim ba, I don't think. Umanichim ba besar of. And they would put chicken in it. Right? So some kind of dish with, you know, soy milk and, I don't know, chicken Kiev or whatever, with like par of cheese. Cheese, cream? I don't know how to make chicken Kiev. Ha'il ve'eno rak mi derabanan. So why can you do that? Because it's only derabanan.
That's why you could do it.
That's why you could do it. You can do it because it's derabanan. What's the Isser in the first place? There is no Isser in the first place. There's nothing Usser about power of milk and chickens. What's he talking about? Let's see in a second. Aval Basar Behema, but if it was, let's say, beef, Yesh Lahaniach Eitzel Hachala, then you'd have to place next to this pseudo milk, Shkedim. You'd have to leave some almonds on the table. Why? So that people said, it's almond milk. I got it. Or why don't you just leave the container? Because it doesn't come in a container. It doesn't come in a container. Mishum maris ayin. So the issue is a maris ayin issue. It's not a kashrus issue per se. It's a maris ayin issue. Maris ayin of kashrus, but maris ayin. So it's an interesting thing that the Ramah is noting. When it comes to a perceived iser derabanan, there's no issue of maris ayin. I don't need to be concerned that you're looking at me thinking that I'm violating an iser derabanan. If it's an iser d'oraisa, so everybody goes into hypersensitivity. You're actually talking about real bona fide Isser D'oraisa, biblical law, very, very scary, Dvar Hashem. So I need to be concerned that about your perception of me as violating that halacha. When it comes to Dina D'Rabbanan, the Rabbanan themselves are never so careful about that. And they didn't impose upon me the challenge of also veering clear of Marasayin as well. Fine. Here's where the Shach comes in. Shach says an interesting thing. If you go straight across and look at the column on the right is the Shach, and then the Vav. It's like smack smack in the middle, halfway down, in the lines where it gets narrow. It's right over there. That vav there. I'm not going to see the whole thing, but at least part of this. Okay, so here's what the shach says. Here's some of the back. And klomar, in other words, here's what's going on. Velo dummy, this is not comparable, lidam dugim, to fish blood. Everybody excited yet? This is, yes, it certainly is. It's not like fish blood. Meaning what? Sof simen samachavav shemutter legamre, that we say it's totally mutter to drink fish blood. How could it be mutter to drink fish blood? What if somebody thinks that I'm drinking cow's blood? You're not allowed to drink cow's blood. You can't drink dam is us. This is why our bubbies and Zaydas spent all that time, probably just our bubbies, let's be honest, salting meat, right? Vafilu hachi, and even so, im kansu bakli, nevertheless, if it's gathered in a kli, usser, then it's prohibited. So meaning I can drink fish blood, it's mutter, but if it's gathered in a cup so that you can't tell if it's fish blood or cow's blood, then it's usser mipnei maris ayin. Question is, right, so why are they different? Right, so why am I allowed to serve chicken in soy milk or almond milk, but I can't drink fish blood because people are going to think that I'm drinking cow's blood? LMK, unless yesh bo kaskasim, unless I keep some scales on the counter or I keep some scales in the container from the fish, scrape the scales up. This is getting more. Everybody ate already, right? This is getting more.
Lime on the cup.
Exactly. Yeah, it's the good. Right. Right. Yeah, you leave like the gill, you know, the head of the fish on the cup, just hanging on by the gill. That's the idea. Shenikar shehu dam dagum. Then it's recognizable that you're drinking fish blood. Dahasam dam gufei asumi d'raisa. You know what the difference is? Bloods and iser d'raisa. So why is it that there's a maris ayin issue of drinking fish blood? Because drinking cow's blood is asumi d'raisa. Whenever it's perceived that I'm violating a biblical prohibition, I have to be concerned about that issue of maris ayin. If the perception is only that I'm violating an iser d'rabbanan, I don't have to be concerned. Hilkach, therefore, haroe, somebody who sees him, yomar, will say the achel dam behema sh'asr midaraisa, that he's eating animal blood, cow blood, and that's asr midaraisa. Aval basar of b'chalav mamish, but even if the person sees me, he thinks I'm eating chicken and milk. Let's say I really was eating chicken and milk. What is that? It's only an iser d'rabbanan. If I was mamish eating that, humi d'rabbanan v'leka l'mecha shel maris ayin. Therefore, you don't have to be concerned about maris ayin. V'lachein, therefore, basar behema b'chalav. If you have basar behema, if you have beef in milk, shehu aser midaraisa, which is a real biblical prohibition. Yesh laniach etzlo shkedim. Then you have to leave out the almonds. Then you have to leave out the soybeans. And you have to leave out the container, the package, the sign, whatever it is, so that you know that it's only parav. Kedei shelo yachshov haroes, that somebody who sees it doesn't think, shehu chalav mamish, that it's really, really milk. By the way, this does not necessarily impact today on drinking soy milk, number one, because we've all become such biki and bedavar, that because it's so ubiquitous, everybody has soy milk. Number one is that there's almost an active presumption that that be the case. And number two, it's so clearly recognizable today. Soy milk does not look like, it just has a different tinge and a different hue, and we're also accustomed and acquainted with it.
Milk and bread
still correct, because there's no way to tell.
Should be a hecker.
Yeah, because there's no way to tell otherwise. Meaning, right. Once it's in the dough, there's no way to tell. Right, exactly. It has to be some sort of hecker in the actual shape of the dough. Therefore, by the way, interesting point. Very, very interesting, but very astute. Therefore, tzarech lomar, you need to say that demairi bebishel, we're talking about as a cooked dish. Why does it have to be a cooked dish that we're talking about in this halacha? Because if it's not cooked, it's also not the iser d'oraisa. Right? If you have salami and cheese sandwich, not an iser d'oraisa. If you put it in the toaster for a couple of minutes, then it's an iser. Maybe an iser d'oraisa. If you boil the salami and cream or whatever, then you have a real iser d'oraisa on your hands. But if you have just meat, right, just meat, just if it's not actually losivashel gadiba chalevimo, if you're not actually cooking it, then it's only an iser d'rabbanan. So he says, therefore, it has to be that this whole halacha is also talking about where it's cooked as well. The ilav hachi afilu baser behemalaka iser d'oraisa, which would mean, says the Shach, that according to the Ramah, what the Ramah would tell you is that if you have like that soy bacon for granted, you know, soy salami with a slice of cheese on top, no worries. because it's only Midr Rabbanan. What are they going to think I'm doing? At most, they'll think that I'm violating an Esedr Rabbanan. I don't have to be concerned with Maris Ayin when it comes to an Esedr Rabbanan. Okay, fine. Vein tzarech lehaniach shkedim. Okay, very good. Yeah, just skip down half a line, I guess. Aval Maharshal. Okay, Aval Maharshal, Perek, Kol Abasar, Simon, Nud Beis. Here's what the Maharshal says. Shlomo Luria, we've spoken about him previously. Aval Maharshal, Lamad Mehach, the Dam Dagim. He did learn from Dam Dagim to say, and extrapolated, that if you can't drink Dam Dagim, if you can't drink fish blood, because it's Maharshal, and it looks like you're drinking real blood, he did extrapolate and say, Dibipurim, I don't know why, but the Bepurim, b'chayotzibo, Purim or other days, when it is the custom, shirigilim le'echol tarnegoles b'chalav shkedim. Don't know why I'm Purim, but for whatever reason, that was a common dish. Maybe we should think of that as a theme for this year. Purim in Hawaii, Philly versus New York, Purim with chicken in almond milk. Get your RSVPs in now. Where we say that that's the minhag of the day, to eat chicken in almond milk, she'aser, it's prohibited, imlo she'aniach shkedim etzlo. So the Marshal says that it's aser. The Marshal argues on the Ramah. And he says, etzlo besochon obetzidan, either you put the almonds in the milk or you leave them next to the milk lehekera, so that it's a heker, so that it's recognizable, that it's different, it's not real milk. Befrat gabi besar of. Specifically, he says it's just the opposite. Specifically in regards to basar of, specifically in regards to chicken, more so than meat, because the lighter the isser, or the less substantial the isser, the more of a reasonable assessment somebody can make to say, oh, maybe it's actually mutter. Right. If I see you eating, if I see you walking into McDonald's, I don't really think McDonald's is I think you're going to the bathroom or that you're getting a soda or whatever it is. Right. But if I see you going into like the Hebrew National stand, oh, I don't know, maybe it's okay. I don't know. Maybe it's something I don't know. Right. So I think he's eating. If I saw him eating beef and milk, I know that it's crazy. But he's eating chicken. Maybe chicken's not so there. Maybe there are people. Yeah, it's okay. So he says specifically in regards to chicken and milk, the ikal mechash tfeshe lo yidamu lomer, that nobody should ever think to say besarof b'chalav shari afil midr rabbanan, that it must be mutter to do so. Rabbi Yossi Agalili, it's actually an opinion in the Mishnah. Rabbi Yossi Agalili holds that chicken and milk is actually totally mutter. Ad kam l'shono, that's what the Marshal says. V'chein hiskimu achronim, and that's what others have said afterwards as well. V'chein nira l'fianios daiti, that's what I hold also. And he goes on to explain why that really makes sense. So that's the Shach's sheet. The Shach argues on the Ramah. So the Ramah says what he says. The Shach makes a point of not just writing his own independent Sefer, makes a point of writing on the Shulchan Aruch and the Ramah. This is what he decides to attach his work to. Argues with the Ramah. It's fascinating. What's fascinating is that the Taz goes through the same rigmarole, quoting this idea of Dam Dagim, and why should there be a difference? Oh, the difference is Issur D'Oraisa and Issur D'Rabbanan. If you go to the other side of the page, it's sort of in the middle of the thin lines, there's an asterisk there. If you just jump to that, where he says, Va'af. So at that asterisk, he says, Va'af ki divrei Ramanachon. This is the Taz speaking. The Taz says, and by the way, and even though the Ramah is absolutely right, the Ramah is absolutely right. There's a difference between, so he's not like the Shach, right? He doesn't refer to the Shach by name, but he says that, you know, anybody would be crazy to say that the Ramah, of course the Ramah is right. Everybody knows that the Ramah is always right. Va'af ki divrei Ramah nechonim, and even though the words of the Ramah are correct, he says, u'chfarnes pashet ha-minag kein, and that's how everybody keeps the minag, that when it comes to a derabanan, that we don't bother worrying about Marasayan, and when it comes to the Yisud Araisa, that's when we're concerned about the issue of Marasayan. Says, yeah, the truth is, listen, no harm, no foul. No pun intended. It seems that it would be bad. Why not leave some almonds there? Put them on, even though it's just chicken, even though it's only Nisadur Abanan. Why not hedge your bets? Why not just make sure that there's no possible questioning one way or the other? Gam Eitzel Basar Oth, Ela B'machom She'en Lo Shkedim, Ein La'esar B'shvil Zeha Achila. He says, I wouldn't say that it's usser if you don't have any almonds to put out, because the Ramah really may ikar adin, the Ramah's right, the Ramah's correct, absolutely, the Ramah, but if you can, you may as well leave some almonds there. That asterisk, what's that asterisk doing there? That goes to the Nekudos HaKesef. right? So this is the Shach answering back on the Taz. It's a very, very terse one, so it's going to end right here. If you go to the far right margin, the second paragraph down where it says Nekudas HaKesef, so he's quoting the words of the Taz, Va'afki divrei Rama nechonim, and even though what the Rama says is really correct. So that's where the Shach jumps in. The Taz says what the Rama says is right. The Shach says, Ze'eno. No, it's not. What he says is wrong. What he says is incorrect. That's not the halacha. Right? The Taz says, even though everything, the Rama says, yes, what the Rama says is absolutely correct. And he says, Ze'eno. Nope, no, it's not. K'mosha kasavti b'shachsin sif katan vav. Just like I wrote in the Shach. It's wrong. It's wrong. No bits of no bones about it. No, doesn't mince his words, and it is what it is. And again, this is all, it needs to be appreciated on the on as high a level as the Shach initially unveils and initially rolls out in his Hakdama himself. He has only the utmost respect for the Rama. He does a little, you know, I don't mean this negatively, he does a little name dropping, and he says, and the Rama, by the way, who happens, I happen to be a grandson, I married into the family, right? He has the greatest respect in the world for the Rama. He attaches his sefer to the Rama, but no bones about it. When he feels that he wants to argue, that he should argue, that he needs to argue, he absolutely does. When he feels that he should argue with the Taz, when he feels that the Taz means something, he absolutely will. But the whole point is that this is just the way that the halachic system works. It's not because of any personal vendettas or anything like that. So again, this is a little sampling of the kinds of issues that the Shach grapples with, and some of the tension that exists between his parish and the Taz's parish. Both are considered extremely important works of halacha, even today, even in terms of Psak Halacha Ad Hayom Hazeh. And you know, again, the final note here is that this is the kind of material, just bear in mind, this is the kind of stuff that the Shach is sitting down at night and writing by candlelight, while there are all kinds of horrible, heinous things taking place outside. Really remarkable fortitude, a remarkable personality, and a very, very important link in the entire Mesorah that we're discussing throughout the series. Mir Tzishim, next time I think we're going to be discussing the Noda Bihuda. Looking forward to doing that next time. Rav Cheska Landau. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.